Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sapphic Carol Club, where we explore lesbian themes in lesbians, 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 and anywhere else sapphics roam. We are your hosts. We are your host. Welcome to 2022. We are a single entity, a mega sapphic. We are your hosts.
I'm one sapphic buddy.
I'm Laurel. Ask me things. That's Chinova.
And I'm Audrey, flung from space knee. Before we begin, Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to 2022, which I'm sure will be great. Super chill.
Yeah.
Not traumatic at all.
Time is an arbitrary construct, but yeah. this year will be very different.
And also, this is our third year as a podcast. I mean, we're entering into the third year, I guess.
The third year in which we have done our anniversary, I think, would be in April,
but we're almost 3 years old. We're still a toddler. We're still super cute. Haven't reached that annoying.
Kind of annoying.
Okay, fine. We're already annoying. I don't know how we've gotten here. It's kind of nuts to me that this is like...
It just keeps happening. It's so weird.
Our 67th episode, I believe. We'll see how long it keeps going.
We keep accidentally still continuing to exist.
We keep accidentally setting up time to record for 2 hours and then editing for several hours and then releasing it.
Yeah.
It's like trip and fall.
So weird.
Comes out of our butts. Who knows? Our cute little butts. Anyway, thank you for joining us for part two of our Carol. What? That's what I wrote. Thanks for joining us for part two of our Carol. Yep. In our last episode, we talked about the poll results that we posted on Instagram and discussed the questions and topics shared by y'all. And today we are going gloves deep into the film.
What about Lincoln? We will be Lincoln tunneling.
We'll be going Lincoln Tunnel Deep?
Yeah, because when they go through the tunnel.
Lincoln Tunnel Deep into... I like gloves deep because it's like, how deep is the glove?
They were long gloves.
Exactly.
Well, the Lincoln Tunnel is also a long tunnel. We're tunneling into the film. Anyway, we're really going into the film.
Is what we're trying to say. And we are also going to be discussing the source material a bit. And it's infamous/notorious author Patricia Highsmith.
Yeah. I have a grimace face.
Is that what it is?
Right now. Yes.
You want to disclaimer this?
Just like in the last episode, this is just going to be a constant barrage of spoilers. So if you haven't seen the movie, go do it. Go see the movie.
If you haven't seen the movie and you listened to our last episode, you know the movie. No, go see it. It's beautiful. That's... Go see the movie. Please do it for us.
Yeah. For yourself.
Okay. Let's kick it off.
Here we go.
Let's talk about The Price of Salt and Patricia Highsmith first, because it might end on a not good note otherwise, and then we'll talk about the film. Mm-hmm. I realize this is kind of a ridiculous episode because, like, I've read the book, Laurel hasn't, so it might just be me, like, throwing a constant barrage of book stuff at her.
And me going like, oh, really?
Maybe you should grab another hot dog.
Wow.
And enjoy that while I talk about the book.
I'll be back.
Okay. Hey, come back. You might know. I mean, I feel like you've probably read enough.
You've read
a bit of book before, so you know what books are.
Yes.
But as everyone I think knows by this point, the film is based on The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith, which was originally published in 1952 under her pseudonym Claire Morgan. I think she denied that she was Claire Morgan for a long time. This is her second book. And
well, maybe the other interesting thing to note is that there are other books by Patricia Highsmith that you might be familiar with, even if you are not familiar with The Price of Salt. She wrote the Bourne Identity series.
She wrote
The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Probably the most famous ones were that and then like Strangers on a Train. Talented Mr. Ripley, if you've seen the movie, I don't know. I think there were a couple movies, but there were like five books. Strangers on a Train, I don't know when the book came out, but the film directed by Hitchcock came out in 1951. She wrote a ton of books. I think this one was the only one with like explicitly lesbian characters in it. But so, yeah, originally it was published in 1952. And then in 1983, the lesbian publishing house Naiad Press offered Highsmith $5,000 to reprint the novel under her own name, which she accepted. And so it was reissued in 1984. And then, maybe more famously, it was republished in 1990 as Carol under Patricia Highsmith's name. And she added an afterword, finally taking full credit of the book. She wrote a ton of books, and apparently there were, like, I think over 20 films have been adapted from her books. A lot of them I've not heard about or heard of or watched. There are pretty dark themes throughout a lot of her books, and Carol might be one of the only ones that has, like, kind of happy ending. So, but apparently the novel was so personal to Highsmith that it was difficult for her to take ownership of it as a writer for many years. It's also very unusual for the time because it had a happy ending, or at least like a not tragic ending, which was way more typical of like lesbian pulp novels at the time. And so for many years, it was considered the only lesbian novel with a happy ending, which is kind of fucked up. She wrote from the afterword of the 1990 reissue, the appeal of The Price of Salt was that it had a happy ending for its two main characters, or at least they were going to try to have a future together. Prior to this book, homosexuals, male and female in American novels, had had to pay for their deviation by cutting their wrists, drowning themselves in a swimming pool, or by switching to heterosexuality, so it was stated, or by collapsing, alone and miserable and shunned, into a depression equal to hell. So she's not wrong.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned this in the previous episode, but it is semi-autobiographical, or at least like the inspiration for it. Highsmith, I think when she was in her mid to late 20s, worked as a temp at Bloomingdale's in their toy department during the holiday season, and she met a beautiful blonde woman who would become her inspiration for Carol. She then secretly followed the woman back to her New Jersey home, so that deviates from the book a little bit.
Deviates in that Therese was invited.
Right, right.
She wasn't. She didn't just stalk her to her house. Oh boy.
But apparently she wrote like the outline for the novel, The Price of Salt, while she was under the influence of chickenpox in a fever. And then, very sadly, the woman who it's based on supposedly committed suicide about 5 months before The Price of Salt was published. And that is a theme throughout Patricia Highsmith's life. So let's talk about Highsmith, who was really fun. Just a lovely woman.
By that, we mean the opposite.
Yeah. But the New York Times described her as a collision of contradictions, which I think is a really good description for her. Oh, actually, one other thing before we get into that is one film that we didn't mention that is another film adapted from her novel is called Deep Water, which is actually coming out next year, or this year, 2022, starring Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas. Just FYI, just, you know, letting you know. I don't know. A lot of Patricia Highsmith movies out there. So it's kind of interesting, like, how so many of her books are adapted. Like, What is it about her writing style that's so adaptable? Mm-hmm. As I mentioned previously, she had a very obsessive and fraught relationship with her mother. She wrote this little poem in, like, 1940 or something that goes, I am married to my mother. I shall never wed another.
That's a thought.
So
there.
Just kind of... Yeah. If you listen to our last episode, we talked a lot about the age gap and not the age gap. Actually, it was more like you mentioned sort of the problematic nature of the relationship between the two. And so
a very matronly, maternal Carol.
And a lot of that comes through in The Price of Salt, way more so than the movie. And obviously that's stemming from a personal place for her because she saw herself as like Therese was basically like her. I mean, not literally, but that's the character that she related the most to in this movie. However, and speaking of characters she most related to, she has said that Ripley from The Talented Mr. Ripley is the character out of all her novels that she related the most to, which, do you remember that story?
I do not.
Did you see the movie?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, this is a spoiler for Talented Mr. Ripley, but it's been out for like 20 years. So he's a sociopath. He murders like several people in the movie.
That sounds right.
He like assumes their identity and he drives Gwyneth Paltrow insane. So it's really telling, I think, that that's like the character she identifies.
Yeah, she's like, oh yeah, that's me.
She's very open about it. Yeah. She's like, I relate most to this character. It's a little creepy. It's like saying... I identify with like Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at least she's upfront about it. You know,
that's true. Like, that's true.
Because you'd want to know before you're dealing with a sociopath that they are a sociopath. And so she's like, yep, that is me. I'm so curious about, I don't know if you get into this later, but Phyllis Nagy's relationship with her. And like, so they were friends, right? Yeah. Like they at least.
They were friends for the last 10 years of her life.
Yeah. It's like So was she?
I mean, she saw her as kind of more of a mentor. She, I've never read anything where she talked about her darker side of
psychopathy.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of one of the situations where it's like, you can't deny how talented this woman is, regardless of the fact, not that nothing about it justifies like her beliefs that she held and how bad of a person she probably was. But I think when you have a relationship with someone like that, it's like kind of hard not to ignore. I mean, I shouldn't say that, but it's like easier to just focus on the things that like work well for you, right? Like that you respect about that person.
Yeah.
I think they had met, it's a weird story, but like most of their relationship was through letters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I think like they had spent some time together briefly. I think Patricia Highsmith was like hired by the New York Times to write a story about a cemetery or something. And Phyllis Nagy was their fact checker and assigned to her story. And so I think that's how they met initially. And then Phyllis Nagy, who's more known as like a playwright, she was a Highsmith super fan. And she eventually adapted, I think, at least one or two of her books into theater. But anyway, yeah, it was mostly through letters. So yeah, given that their relationship was mostly through letters, I would imagine that maybe it's easier to kind of ignore the more controversial aspects of Highsmith's personality.
Yeah.
So it probably goes without saying, but Highsmith was, I don't know if she identified as a lesbian, but she definitely had a lot of relationships, a lot of relationships with women. She didn't like to speak publicly about her sexuality, even in her private journals, which are available. She has like, her diaries were published. Any reference to homosexuality appeared under the opaque acronym NOEPS, which stood for Notes on Ever-Present Subject.
Yeah.
I think it kind of consumed her.
Nopes. But she had relationships with men too. Were they just not like...
The sense I got was because it was just the norm.
Yeah, okay.
I think she struggled with her sexuality. There was a lot of self-hatred there. I believe she was engaged to a man. I don't know if she ever married him when she met the woman who would inspire Carol.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Oh, like Therese, huh? Like
oh, sort of almost.
On the brink
yeah,
of
on
marriage,
the brink of... Kind of yeah. Yeah, I guess, yeah. She loved snails. She was obsessed with snails.
That's so random.
She like was walking home one day and saw two snails like making love and became like, she took them home and became obsessed with them.
Wow.
I think she mentioned something about like how you can't really tell what their sex is. And,
yeah. Okay. Sure.
You know, there was that aspect of it. But I think she also became, I think she was an obsessive person, which is like something that comes through in Therese as well. Well, at least in the book more so than in the movie. At one point, she had like 300 snails in her, like her backyard or something. She was so obsessed with them that she reportedly went to a party once with a handbag full of snails as well as a head of lettuce to feed them in the bag.
Wow.
And then at some point, she was traveling from, I think, like France to England and couldn't legally travel with the snails. And so she smuggled them to England by hiding 10 snails under each breast.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I love that she... I don't love. So she's a sociopath.
Who loves snails.
But deep love for snails.
I think she also loved cats. So she's not like a psychopath, maybe.
Right.
Know. If you so love cats, you can't be. She actually has these really, really cute cat drawings. Like she did a little bit of illustration. I was like, oh, you're so terrible, but look at your cute cats.
I guess that's the interesting thing about like diagnoses of people's sort of mental and emotional issues, right? So like even the DSM, it's like you can't just pinpoint like, oh, this person is a psychopath, this person is a sociopath. There's just like an intersection of personality, and even sexuality isn't like a binary,
right?
So like people are not either a sociopath or a psychopath. They can have like layers of both that overlap each other in these strange ways. And so clearly, like, she's not going around like murdering animals or anything. It's not like a deep psychopathy
that we know of, probably not,
right? Yeah,
yeah,
but
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's just so, it's so strange.
I guess she contained multitudes.
She everyone contains multitudes. She loved snails and she hated Jews. Like this is such a strange person anyway.
Yeah, she was pretty outspoken about being anti-Semitic.
Amongst other things.
Amongst like, other things, yeah. I think. I don't have like quotes for this, but one of her biographers, the one who wrote The Talented Miss Highsmith, described her as a Jew hater when she wasn't calling the Holocaust Holocaust Inc. She was referring to it as the Semi-Cost, implying that Highsmith was disappointed that the Jewish population hadn't been completely destroyed. So anyway, not a great person. I think that just scratches the surface.
Seems like... So Jews were like the center of her ethnicity-based hatred.
I think they were at the center, but I don't think she liked Asians or Black people, or maybe people of color.
Or she
in
did.
General.
I think she liked. So on at least in Wikipedia, it says that she did get along with Black people early in her life, and then she grew into a sort of racist or more racist stance.
Thank you for that detail. I guess. Make it better.
Yeah, no. It definitely doesn't. No, it really doesn't.
I think Phyllis Nagy described her as someone who was always on guard and, you know, someone who didn't trust others easily, but also someone who I think once, you know, she did trust you, could be quite sensitive and kind. But that sounds like it's very much on a personal level. Like, obviously her beliefs are questionable at best.
If you approached her very, very slowly, like maybe on the ground.
As a snail? Sort of, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Just as a snail? Saying,
yeah. Kind of slimy.
As Isabella Rossellini. Yeah. It's kind of slimy. Eating like a head of lettuce.
Yeah.
Hiding under her boob. Yeah.
Slowly. Just cradling yourself under her boob. It's the way to her heart.
Yeah. So that's like my cliff notes on Patricia Highsmith. There have been 3 biographies written about her.
Including the recent
one. Yeah, there was one that just came out. And then there's an earlier one, I think, that was called like Beautiful Shadows or something. I heard that one. Heather and I were like looking into which one to like get. And I didn't get any in time because for some reason, they're not rentable or borrowable through the library. Mm-hmm. So I was like, mm-hmm. I'm not paying for a book right now. Why am I so cheap? I mean, buy books. Don't buy them from Amazon.
Yeah.
And then also her diaries were published. But actually, there's a really, really good New York Times article about her that we can link to because I don't think you necessarily need to read all the books. But it's called The Many Faces of Patricia Highsmith. Okay. You want to talk about Carol?
Boy, do I. So Carol premiered at Cannes in 2015, had a 10-minute standing ovation, like another film that we know.
What film
it
is
was
that?
Directed by Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It was
Portrait
directed
of a Lady
by,
on Fire.
by Todd Haynes, who also directed Safe, Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, Velvet Goldmine, lots of stuff. He's done a lot of things. He's a gay man. I feel like we mentioned that a lot in the last episode, but the screenplay for this, it's based on the book, of course, and the screenplay was written by Phyllis Nagy, who we mentioned earlier, friend and mentee, I guess, and super fan of Patricia Highsmith.
Yeah, she's mostly known as a playwright. This was like not her feature film debut, because she had done one other film for HBO, but this, I guess, like theatrical film debut was Carol that she wrote for. And then she's actually directing, I guess it's in post now, but she directed a film called Call Jane, which is coming out, and I think it's about abortion.
I like the way you said abortion. Like,
abortion.
One interesting note about Phyllis Nagy's involvement with this is that I think, so you mentioned in the previous episode that it took like what 12
I think
12
it took
years,
at least
years?
10 years like, to like get off the ground, but I think maybe more, maybe 20, but Phyllis Nagy has been involved.
She was like the only person who
the
was
the whole time for 20 years she's been working on the film. So I mean, imagine if it had come out in like the early 2000s, like what would that have been? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just trying to think of like other lesbian films that came out around that time, and I don't know. I mean,
did it already have a director attached back then when it got optioned?
It had like a couple different directors. It wasn't until the most recent round that it had Todd Haynes.
Do you remember who any of them were?
Not off the top of my head. It was another, I think it was like mostly straight white men. Of course.
Was it Spielberg?
It was Steven Soderbergh.
Aaron Sorkin's Carol.
Oh my god. Yes.
Okay, so it stars, if you didn't know, it stars Cate Blanchett, Rooney Mara, Sarah Paulson, Kyle Chandler, who, thank you for adding this. I was like, where is this guy from? Friday Night Lights, obviously.
Yeah, Coach. Your favorite.
Jake Lacy. Yeah, my favorite. Jake Lacy, who was, if you have seen White Lotus, you have seen him in he's typecast as this like dude.
He's really typecast as like the most punchable guy.
Oh,
I kind of feel bad. I wonder if he's like just a really nice guy in person, but maybe one day he'll get to play a role where I don't want to punch him in the face.
An entitled just jerk. And there is a brief cameo by Carrie Brownstein of Portlandia / Sleater-Kinney. Brain for coming through.
Good job, Brain / What is that thing that she's maybe most famous for?
I also wondered if, like, Carrie Brownstein's role was, we mentioned this in the last one, that Sarah Paulson had a bigger edit before all the edits, I guess. Or she had more scenes or something. Didn't she have a bigger role?
She did. She had a bigger role in the book.
Oh,
I think in the screenplay she had a bigger role. In general, the screenplay just is way more, I don't know. I think if they filmed the screenplay, it would have been like 3 or 4 hours long.
Ooh.
But is that what you were going to ask, if she had a bigger role in the?
Yeah, I was, because Carrie Brownstein's part is so small.
It's so brief. And maybe they filmed this, but yeah, she, in the screenplay at least, I can't remember the book, but I want to say the book probably too, because I feel like the screenplay was kind of like in between, like sort of the transition between the book and the film, what they finally arrived at. But yes, it wasn't a big role by any means, but she had probably a couple scenes with Therese and like definitely a longer conversation. She had a little, slightly more like fleshed out personality, and in the screenplay and possibly in the book, she actually like invites her to this other party that's like a special party at my place, hint hint.
That's,
you know,
what I was wondering. Okay, yeah,
but they made it a little bit more sort of subtle, like, what's going on over here?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that's the movie. When did you first watch it?
Oh, man.
I feel like it was recent-ish, right? Didn't you see Portrait first?
I may have seen Portrait first. Yeah, I think so.
I think it was kind of like Portrait, if I remember correctly, like you were like a little bit worried that it was going to have a effed up ending. Am I right?
Yeah.
Like you're going to be traumatized?
Yeah. Because it's like, I mean, I didn't realize that it was written by a lesbian. But even if I did know that, I think
if you knew it came out in 1953 or whatever, like, or 52,
yeah, exactly, it's like, no, yeah. I know what those pulp novels are like. And also, yeah, so I was like, there is no way a movie about two lesbians in the 1950s is gonna end well. And so I was like, nope, I'm not watching it until I forget what finally, maybe we were gonna,
I probably pressured you.
Yeah, that's great, thank you.
You're welcome.
So yeah, probably pretty recently, definitely not when it first came out. How about you?
I don't know how, but Heather ended up with a couple free tickets for like the SF premiere or whatever before it came out. I didn't know anything about it. I was not like obsessed with Cate Blanchett at the time. And I was like scared.
What? There was a time?
I know.
When you were.
Yeah, imagine that.
I cannot.
When I was in the womb. And I saw it in my mother's womb. Okay, that's weird.
But also appropriate.
Yeah, right. So I went in blind, kind of like Portrait, where I really didn't know anything about it. At least with Portrait, I'd seen like a trailer. And I was just like totally blown away. I was like totally speechless at the end. I had not really seen, I think, a film quite like that ever, especially with the happy-ish ending part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
2015, 2016 was maybe not that long ago, but I was still sort of accustomed to traumatizing endings in queer film. I know it's a complicated topic, and there's a lot to say about, you know, cishet actors portraying queer characters in movies. But at the time, seeing two very famous and, you know, well-regarded actors playing these roles, and how there wasn't this, like, huge fuss made about it and how it might impact their careers, it was refreshing to me, at least at the time.
Yeah,
I was like, damn, this is giving me all the feels, and I just loved it, and that's how I felt. what was your reaction to it? Because if you saw it after Portrait, like, that's rough. Not that everything has to be compared to Portrait, but it's hard not to, because it set the bar so much higher, right?
Yeah, totally.
Do you remember
the
feelings?
I definitely wasn't like punched in the gut the way that I was with Portrait, but there were so many moments throughout the film where I was like, oh, this is so great. You know, this is such a great film. The chemistry between the two leads was great. It's a beautiful film. And I loved the ending. Yeah. It's such a great ending. But yeah, definitely not like as strong a reaction post-Portrait. And I saw it on my TV in my living room, you know, so.
Better than your laptop.
Not quite the film. I know. Not quite the like beautiful filmic experience it probably deserved.
Yeah. To provide like a synopsis of this film, let's hear what Kate and Rooney have to say.
Special
about
guests. Yeah.
Special guests, Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. Let's hear what they say the film is about.
It originates from a Patricia Highsmith novel called The Price of Salt originally, and then renamed Carol, about a young woman called Therese who is in the process of finding out who she is, really, and sort of idolizes and then falls in love with a woman called Carol Aird, who I play.
It's a love story at its core. Everyone can have a reaction to it because most people, hopefully, have experienced love in their lives. Most of Patricia Highsmith's novels are about sort of the criminal mind, and this is her only novel that's not about the criminal mind, it's about the amorous mind.
Thanks for joining us, Kate and Renee. You can go back to whatever you're doing. Being beautiful. Okay, let's try this. We're gonna try this out. We're gonna just like provide a synopsis for the film, which is kind of long, 11 pages.
Is it a synopsis at that point?
I know. We're going to just read.
Retelling.
Laurel and I are going to read the parts of Carol and Therese, but in our Muppet voices. Hello there. Ask me things.
I'm going to stay in a monotone the whole time.
Okay. We're not going to do that. But let's try the synopsis. It'll be like a nice little refresher for anyone who's, you know, if you haven't seen the film recently. And then maybe we can just chime in with some thoughts.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Let me try to kick this off. Okay, so the film starts in their present time with Therese and Carol sitting in a restaurant. Things seem pretty tense between the two, but as an audience, we don't really know what's going on yet. And then they're rudely interrupted by a friend of Therese, Jack, who basically like takes her to a party, and then Carol leaves as well.
The way this man yells across the restaurant just gave me so much anxiety. And no one else turned. It was just...
Therese! Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, can you not just walk the 15 feet to like make sure it's her?
So we get to this later because this film is not linear, right? Like, we're starting in the end, essentially, mm-hmm. or near the end. But when I watched this again recently, I was like, oh my God. This is the jump scare of patriarchy.
Yeah,
you know?
It totally is. Yeah, totally.
Even though there's more men and interaction with men in this movie, it still feels like that. Like, it feels like jarring in that way both times it happens.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so after this scene, it jumps to the past, and that's when we learn that Therese is an aspiring photographer who is working this temp job during the holidays at this department store in Manhattan called Frankenberg's.
The cut to the past itself is also very interesting because you don't quite realize that it's what's happening because she's in the car. She's in the car to the party, but then it starts to sort of like blend her memories.
I think in the screenplay, it's a little bit more clear because she like sees this woman who has like blonde hair and kind of looks a little bit like Carol. And the woman's wearing like a green scarf. And so it's like probably a little bit more like visually stunning.
Mm-hmm.
And then
yeah.
It cuts to the scene in the toy store where Carol is there wearing a very similar looking scarf.
Mm-hmm.
I think you get a little bit of that. But in the film, like, yeah, of course, it's like not as obvious.
It doesn't say like 3 months or like 2 years ago
right, or something.
There's no indication.
So yeah, we find out she's like working in Frankenberg's as a temp.
This is, of course, where they meet for the first time. They spot each other from across the store. There are sudden and deep looks.
looks.
Carol is looking for a doll that her daughter asked for. Her daughter, Rindy. And Therese says that they're sold out of that one. Carol says, like, what was your favorite doll? And she's like, well, actually, I wanted a train. And that's kind of like a, oh, you're not quite like other girls, are you? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the first, like, big hint of queerness that we get as an exchange between the two. So Carol kind of perks up and she says, anyway, Therese talks her into a train. Well, Carol lets herself get talked into a train set. And then this is where Carol leaves her gloves, probably accidentally, as established in the last episode. But this is Therese uses the sales slip with Carol's name and address and mails the gloves back to her later that evening after staring at them longingly.
Meanwhile, Therese has this boyfriend named Richard, Mr. Bunchable, who wants to marry her and also take her to Europe, etc., to yawn.
Richard, which is long for dick. Sorry.
Thanks.
He's kind of a dick.
He's a little bit of a dick. Yeah, he's a dick. He's a dick. He's not the worst. He's not the biggest dick, but he's a dick.
He's not. He's just a dude.
They also have a mutual friend named Danny who works at the New York Times. And when Danny learns that Therese is an aspiring photographer, he invites her to the office in the evening.
To meet, like, a junior editor who's not there.
Yeah, this seems a little questionable. And he kind of takes this opportunity to not entirely consensually smooch on her. And he's like...
Did you mind?
And she's like, no. But then he does it and she, like, is clearly uncomfortable and leaves. then he asks her to come back later. So this is kind of like a to be continued moment, I guess.
And then so we jump back to Carol, who we find out is getting a divorce from her husband, Harge, which is short for Harges.
Harges. Oh, that makes sense. I had a hard time saying his name. It was like Harge. Like, yeah. What is his name? Harge.
It's
okay.
An interesting
like
name.
Like Marge, but Harge.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Great. Harge.
Okay. Who has a much smaller role in the book.
Interesting. Yeah. So she has received the train set and the gloves, and she calls Therese at the department store to thank her for sending them. And as Harge will later accuse her of being, it's very bold, she invites her to lunch as a thank you. So they meet at a restaurant near the department store where Carol orders her iconic spinach over poached eggs, along with a dry martini with olives. Therese orders the same thing because, as she says herself, she doesn't know what she wants. And there are a bunch more looks here.
This scene is so ridiculous. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. It's also where we get one of the more famous lines from the film, which is, "You're such a strange girl." And she says, "Why?" And then it's like, flung. She doesn't even answer. She just says, "Flung out of space."
I love that part so much. Yeah, that felt so real, where she was like, "Why?" And she's like, "I'm not going to respond to that." Flung out of space.
Yeah.
This scene is so crazy. Like, it's almost hard to look at because Carol's flirting so aggressively, like with her like eyes. And you're just like, ah.
Yeah.
But at lunch, this is where Carol invites Therese over to her place on Sunday, where she's like, just "What do you do
bold,
on Sundays?"
Bold,
and
bold.
It's like, come over to my place on Sunday. Would you want to
come
over?
And this is what we said it in the last episode, but when we said that she probably didn't leave her gloves on purpose, like as a ploy, it's because she does things like this.
Right.
She's like, "Hey, come to my house."
Yeah. She's like very unapologetic about it, too. It's like, I don't think she's like embarrassed about anything she asks, even when she's like rejected, you know?
Yeah.
So skipping head a little bit. I think there's some scene like at some Christmas party or something, but forget that. Straight people, boring. But Carol picks Therese up in Manhattan on Sunday and then drives her to her house, which I think is in New Jersey. And on, I don't know why I laughed. Sorry, people who live in New Jersey.
Oh, and this is
New Jersey.
This is where that tunnel scene comes in. And I think the reason the tunnel scene is so deeply entrenched in my mind is because I think this is kind of where the story starts to flip between the two characters a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like, we've been following Therese.
That's true.
And then we go through this tunnel, and there's this, it's a really beautifully edited
scene. Yeah.
Shot and edited. But this is where we start to see more of Carol's life and all the things that she's going through.
Yeah, that's right. And then on the way there, they stopped by a Christmas tree. And this is where Therese, things start to like grow a little bit for Therese, because up until this point, she hasn't really been taking photos of like humans, just mostly of like pigeons in nature.
And she said, "And windows."
Yeah.
Okay.
I just love how awkward she is. And then, like, while Carol's buying this Christmas tree, she, Therese kind of pops out of the car and starts taking photos of her from, like, a distance, which is, like, a little bit creepery, but also adorable.
And Carol seems very into it as well. She's kind of like, oh, she catches her, and then she starts to, like, do her hair and, like, turn.
She's like, no.
Yeah. So they get to the house, and this is one of those moments where Allie and I were like, oh, mother-daughter, because Therese steps out of the car in almost an identical outfit to what Rindy is wearing as she comes out of the house, like running to meet Carol.
Yeah.
A plaid skirt and like a dark top with a headband and the same haircut. So they get to the house and they hang out for a little bit. Carol is fiddling with the train set or wrapping gifts. I think she's wrapping gifts, actually. And Therese is playing piano. And then at one point, Carol comes over and puts her hands on her shoulders while she's playing. like no big deal. This is what people do when other people are playing piano for them in their house for the first time. And Therese stops, as one would probably when one is being shouldered.
Shouldered.
When one is shouldering someone else. But this is unfortunately interrupted by Harge showing up unannounced. And Carol freaks out, and there's a tension that's not quite explained, but you sort of put together that he's angry that she's surprised that he's home, because he's, you know, he's like, "You're my wife, and why can't I just come and visit my wife?" And eventually he starts fixing the sink, which was like an interesting thing, and something goes wrong with it, and he gets very upset, but he's upset clearly about like lots of things and not just the sink, and he storms out, and he confronts Therese. He's just like, how do you know my wife? And Therese is like, I work at a department store, and she left her gloves.
Yeah.
And
obviously.
Carol was like, and I, you know, and I thanked her. And I thought actually that this would be excuse enough, mm-hmm. but Harge, I think, knows her more than I assumed he did. And he's like, that's bold. Because he knows that he invited her over because of this, or because she's kind of into her.
Right.
So they end up fighting outside the house as well. And Therese sees them through the window, but she tries to tune it out by turning up the record that's playing. And he leaves eventually, but Carol is clearly unhappy. And she drives Therese to the train station, where Therese boards a train and cries on the way home.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, so relatable as a baby gay.
So we were kind of like, it was a stressful situation, but what do you think triggered her crying explicitly? Is it because she was disappointed that, like, things didn't turn out differently, or like,
I mean, I think like Carol didn't treat her well. She like snapped at her, you know.
Yeah.
And I think she's really sensitive.
Her crush snapped at her.
At her. I think she was expecting, like, I don't know what her expectations were, but it's like everything went south.
Definitely not that,
you know. And like, I think she was saying all these things like, let me go out and get you cigarettes.
Oh, right.
And then,
yeah,
like, she's
trying
I could take a taxi home or something like that. Mm-hmm. I feel like she's saying those things hoping that the outcome would be different, like maybe that Carol would be like, no, don't worry about it, everything's fine. But she like actually is like, you're leaving, I'm taking you to the train station. Like, it's so crushing. I feel like I've been in that situation with like an older woman as like a teen or something, you know, where it's like things don't go how you were hoping, whatever that hope was.
Yeah.
And any little thing could like really set it off.
Yeah.
Because she's so internal, like everything she's feeling is so internalized. I think she's dealing with a lot of like conflicting emotions and like doesn't really know what's going on like internally and emotionally. And so it's probably all that build up too, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Carol actually calls the next day to apologize, and she like owns up to it. She's like, I treated you terribly. And then basically invites herself over.
Yeah.
And then I think that same day or shortly after, she learns from her divorce attorney that Harge is petitioning the court to consider a morality clause to basically get full custody of their daughter because homo.
Mm-hmm.
And Carol says this thing about like how if Harge can't have her, she can't have Rindy, basically. So obviously she's super upset. But while she's like outside smoking, or probably, I'm assuming she's smoking because she's constantly smoking in this film, she notices like this fancy Canon camera through a shop window, and it basically implies like she buys this as a gift for Therese. And so when she shows up at Therese's place later, this really made me laugh. Therese opens the door, and like Carol like kind of slides the gift in the camera in the box through the threshold of the door with her like foot.
It's in a suitcase.
It's like a nice camera probably, and like I'm sure it's heavy, but it's just like the way that she like kicks it, it's not a kick, it's just like a push with her foot.
Yeah.
something about this whole thing that it feels like very naughty to me. It's like a power move.
It's such a strange setup too, like she's in the doorway, she's not inside, she doesn't present the gift like while they're sitting in the living room, she pushes it to her with her foot, and then so that sort of forces Therese to like get on the ground and open the gift while looking up at her. You know, it's a very sort of sub-dom position.
Oh, it totally is. I think that's why I'm like, this is kind of kinky.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But it's also like, this was also one of those other instances where it's like that the matronizing theme comes in, because she just found out that she's kind of on the brink of losing her daughter. And so she decides to buy a gift for her, like...
It is also the holiday season.
It's the holiday.
Come on.
Sure.
It's
great.
Christmas. I mean, Therese is also buying her a gift at the same time, albeit
right,
less
just
expensive.
Just like you would buy your mom a gift. A little,
or
little present.
Or the person you are crushed out on. <I know. laughs> Wow.
Okay.
Stop trying to sell this narrative.
I don't need to sell it.
Oh my God.
It's all over the place.
Okay. All right. So at Therese's place, this is where Carol tells her she's like planning on getting away and going on a road trip. So she, of course, invites Therese, who she's known for 2 days, who says yes, because she says yes.
Very
to
lesbian
everything.
Move.
Very. Oh, yeah. This is like the U-Haul move.
Yeah.
Although that comes back later, too.
Yeah, it's true. She U-Hauls twice. So they go on the road trip. Carol wants to head west from Manhattan, and so how far west do they go? I don't know. Anyway.
The Midwest, like Chicago was the destination, I think. Or that was, yeah. Chicago was one of the earlier destinations. I think they end up in like Ohio.
This pisses off Therese's boyfriend, of course, because he's like, wait, I wanted to take you on a steamer ship to Paris and you have been so on the fence about it. But now you're using your trip savings to go on this road trip with this woman that you just met. He's a little irate. I don't get it. I don't understand his point of view here at all. But when does it get gay? It gets gay during this trip.
An hour and 15 minutes into the film.
In Waterloo. Oh, so maybe like in real time with this podcast.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. This is getting edited. Anyway, okay, so it's New Year's Eve. And they talk about how they tend to spend New Year's. Carol is usually spending it
away from Harge, I think is what she said.
Yeah. And Therese says that she usually spends it alone, but in crowds.
Well, then she says, like, I'm not alone this year. And I think she kind of like, look, yeah, this is the best scene. I mean, it's one of the best scenes in the film because.
And they're just talking to each other, like both facing this mirror. Yes. So they're kind of like looking at each other in the mirror, but also themselves. And then Carol unties her robe.
That is like the power move. Like, don't even kiss her first or anything else. No other indication, really. Obviously, like, she has her hand on her shoulders because she loves that position. Oh, this is where she's brushing her hair too, by the way. But she fucking unties her robe, which just like opens up.
Like, yeah.
And
yeah.
Then she leans down to kiss her. Yep. And then Therese asks her to take her to bed.
And this is such a high point. And then it just goes off a cliff emotionally. After the scene is where we cut to Harge, who has shown up at Abby's house. And we get this great interchange where he's like angry and desperate, very aggressive. But it's in the middle of all this that he says to Abby, I love her. I love Carol. Right. And Abby says, I can't help you with that.
Such a good moment.
And she closes the door on him. And he lets her close the door at this point. He's like kind of held it open. And then this is where things start to fall apart for Carol and Therese, because Carol receives a telegram at the motel, which is weird because nobody should know where she is. The telegram is very clearly upsetting. And
we don't know exactly what it says, but yeah.
Yeah. She storms out. She gets the gun from her suitcase, which she has a gun. She gets it from her suitcase. And she opens the door next to their room and finds this guy who they'd kind of talked to at a previous destination.
He's selling notions, supposedly.
Yeah. And she looks around the room and you can see how he's set up his wiretapping.
So
and he's recorded them and she demands the tapes at gunpoint. And he's very sort of nonchalant. He says, they're already gone. I sent them to your husband. And Therese has caught up with Carol at this point and witnesses the whole thing. She reads the telegram.
And then they leave.
Thank you. Yeah, I was like, well, she says something to him, right?
Like, she's like, how could you, or something like that. And he was like, yeah. It's nothing personal. I'm just doing my job, basically.
Yeah, yeah. He also refers to her by name, which is creepy. Like,
yeah.
Miss Bellavette or something.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, that she had a gun, because I feel like at one point earlier, like at a previous stop, Therese found the gun when she was looking for some top for Carol, who was showering. Yeah. She saw the gun earlier and like on the way to the restaurant or, you know, that night, she was like, are you scared of me? Do you feel safe around me? And like,
yeah,
but it's never mentioned like why she brought the gun. I think I got the sense that like she was worried something like this would happen, essentially, or like maybe not this exact thing, but that Harge would somehow find her, you know?
Yeah. So they get to the next hotel and they are very sweet to each other still. But the morning after, Therese wakes up alone in bed, she's still undressed from the night before. And she looks in the corner of the room and Abby is there instead of Carol. And Therese realizes that Carol is gone and Abby is there to drive her home, which is like, wow. I mean, like, she's...
I can't believe, like,
she came from New York.
Yeah, she, like, flew over just to drive her lover, her ex's lover home. Like, what a lesbian thing to do.
Yeah. It's very
gay. Can't tell you how many times I've done this for exes.
Yeah. But this is where Therese realizes that Carol... So Abby gives her a letter as well, and Carol says that they can't see each other. And Therese is devastated.
Yeah. It's a very beautifully written letter. It's clear that, like, Carol cares about her, but she's like, we can't really have contact because she's trying to make this case that she's, like, you know, moral enough to be a mother, I guess. Ugh. But, yeah, that's kind of, like, where things end. So a bunch of time passes. We don't know how much time exactly, but we see Carol trying to basically like be this moral mother, quote unquote, that's like expected of her to get joint custody of her daughter. She's seeing a psychologist. And Teresa is now working at the New York Times. But in the midst of this, Carol finally gets fed up with trying to live within the constraints of 1950s heteronormativity and basically tells everyone at the law office, like including Harge, that she can't do anymore and she just wants visits with her daughter, even if they're supervised. She says, that's the deal, take it or leave it. I won't negotiate it.
And I think she also said, like, I won't and I can't negotiate anymore.
Yeah, she just kind of stands up and is like, no, I'm done. She says, like, if he leaves it, it'll go to court and it'll get ugly and we're not ugly people, Harge. So that's kind of like the end of that.
One more thing on the Harge stuff. This is another thing that I've gleaned from like interviews about the book, but I think in the book, he's a lot more of just like a villain, like a one-dimensional sort of bad guy kind of.
Yeah, we're going to talk about differences in the between the book and the film. Right after this.
Okay. Great. Never mind.
If we get to this. Yeah. So while Therese is at the New York Times office, she gets a letter from Carol basically asking her to meet. She immediately crumbles it and throws it in the trash and just...
Not immediately. She like stares at it for a bit. Well, and she's had it sitting next to her. You know, like she got it. She received it in that like editor's room, and then
how long had it been sitting there? Because I thought she had just read it and she was like,
well,
contemplating.
So she was taking notes where all the photo editors were like talking about pictures, and then she reads it there, I think, and then she takes it to like wherever her desk is, and then it's just like sitting by her as she's typing, and then she looks at it again, and then she
contemplates it for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then that kind of brings us back to the beginning of the film, like where we first started.
So the meeting that we saw in the first scene of the film is the meeting that Carol was asking for in that letter. So this is sort of the penultimate bookend to the film. So Therese does end up going. She meets her at the restaurant. And this time we're looking at it from Carol's point of view and we get more of the conversation. Carol talks about how much Therese has blossomed and she updates her on her life, which is that she has her own apartment now. They're selling the house. She's got a job as a furniture buyer. And then she just goes ahead and asks Therese to move in with her.
This is like my favorite thing ever. She's like, I got my own apartment. It's really big. I don't suppose you want to move in with me.
Yeah. And this is where Therese says no for the first time, like adamantly in the film. She says, no, I don't think so. And Carol brushes it off. Or, you know, she doesn't acknowledge it,
like barely.
Reveal that she's, yeah. And she says, well, I'm meeting some other people later at this restaurant. And you should come if you change your mind. And then she just like slides in with, I love you.
Yeah.
It was just, and then this is when the jump scare, we get the same jump scare, but it's a jump scare again, anew. It's like, afresh, or Jack's like, Therese, hey.
The emotional like domino effect of this scene is nuts. Like you're like, what? She asked her to move in? She loves her? Jack, shut up, what's going on? I'm feeling too many things at once.
Yeah.
It's such a good scene and I love that they show it twice, you know, because I feel like you're gonna see it from both their perspectives and like process it differently. But I also love this scene because it's really like the first time we get to see Therese blossomed, I guess. I think the way they do it in the film is very graceful. It doesn't feel like overt. Previously in the film, like she's saying yes to everything. She seems very uncertain of herself. She even looks really young. Like you kept saying, she looks like Rindy. Yeah. And then now at this restaurant, you're like, I mean, she literally looks like Audrey Hepburn, you know?
Yeah.
In this moment. And she finally says no for the first time and Carol leaves and then Therese goes to Phil's party with Jack, where she has a brief implied flirtation with Carrie Brownstein's character.
Oh, I didn't see this as flirty. Like I saw maybe flirting on Carrie Brownstein's part, but...
Yeah, sorry, not with her, but Carrie Brownstein's, I think her name is like Genevieve or something, is flirting with her, I think.
Oh,
sort of.
It.
It's very subtle.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you're interpreting like something's going on. It's definitely not like explicit. You know, she's like one of the only other people there who's like not with a partner, I guess. She briefly sees Richard too, who is dancing with another woman. And then she leaves the party by herself and you don't really know where she's going. She's kind of like walking down the street.
We see her walk into sort of fancier place and she is about to walk into this restaurant, but a host stops her or tries to stop her, but new Therese is having none of it. He's like, no, you can't go in without a, and his voice fades because she's already in. But she's looking for Carol. And maybe for the first time, the camera is sort of shaky.
Yeah, there's this moment where, like, she's walking in, and then as the camera's looking for Carol slash us, it mimics, you know, the shaky camera, like, human movement thing. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting, because I feel like through the rest of the film, it's, like, pretty smooth.
I feel like there might have been a couple other scenes where it was shaky.
It's possible, but it was more noticeable at this point to me.
Yeah, I think maybe for another sort of, like, heavy emotional scene, it was shaky. But, yeah, so the camera is in Therese's point of view, and we are Therese.
We are Therese.
And we finally find Carol, who is looking at us. But it takes a while. It takes a while to find Carol in the crowd. The anticipation builds, which is really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then she looks at us. Oh, my gosh. And you see a smile, a very slight but very...
Oh, my God. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's so perfect.
A very clear smile starts to form in her face, and it's a really beautiful ending.
I don't know if anyone else could have played that character. Like, I don't... There's something about Kate... Blanchett's face.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Like,
I really can't either. So because the film doesn't entirely capture, you know, what's happening internally with these characters, I wanted to read a quick excerpt from the end of the book. So Highsmith wrote, "It would be Carol. In 1,000 cities, 1,000 houses, in foreign lands where they would go together, in heaven and in hell. Carol saw her, seemed to stare at her incredulously a moment while Therese watched the slow smile growing. Before her arm lifted suddenly, her hand waved a quick, eager greeting that Therese had never seen before. Therese walked toward her." I mean, I don't think she waves in the film, but...
Yeah, no, she definitely doesn't. Like, hi, it's you, hey.
In a way, this feels like kind of the Carol part two, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, where it speaks to their, like, love. Mm. And something I don't think we actually talked about earlier... is, like, if I had to, like, sum up what this film was, like, very briefly, I would say it's a love story. Like, I think it's, like, very much two people falling in love. And that's, like, it. You know?
Yeah.
It's just deeply love story. And I love the ending. As I mentioned in the last episode, I feel like it's a happy ending without being sappy.
Yeah.
Definitely
not
tragic. And we covered it. We went through the entire movie.
We did the whole thing.
We didn't do a watch along, but we talked in depth about, I don't think we've even done this for Portrait, or like scene by scene practically, right?
We haven't. Wow. Yeah. Wait, was this podcast just a long con from you to get us to talk about Carol scene by scene?
Anyway. So we saved this question from the last episode from My Black Shroud, who wanted us to talk about the differences between the book and the movie. And so I guess this is going to be me talking at Laurel, but maybe...
I have a couple of things.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
So I think this is interesting because it's unusual in that the plot of the film follows the book very closely. I think there are even like lines taken directly from the book.
Definitely like Flung from Space was one.
Yeah. As you mentioned previously, a big difference obviously is like Therese is an aspiring set designer in the book, but a photographer in the film.
Oh, the Waterloo line was also in the book. Like...
Oh, yeah, that's
right.
What
place are we in again? Waterloo? Isn't that awful? Yeah.
Yeah, a lot is from the book. It's especially, I think, in the beginning, it's very similar. You mentioned Harge. He actually has a very, very small role in the book. I think you're right. It's a little bit more black and white, but he's like barely in the book at all. And I think it makes sense for them to use him as this tool for like, what is the conflict that she's dealing with, for him to have a bigger role in the movie. The book is mostly from, I think I mentioned this last time, but it's mostly from Therese's point of view. I don't think we get Carol's point of view at all. Like, I don't think we really like see what's happening in the way that we do in the movie.
Right. With like the custody stuff and the divorce and everything.
Yeah, exactly. I would say the biggest deviation between the book and the film is the road trip. In the movie, Carol flies back to New York and Abby shows up to drive Therese back. So in the novel, the road trip is really stretched out. They actually know that Harge has hired a detective to follow them. And at one point, Carol confronts him while he's following them on the road. And he repeatedly tells Carol to return to New York, which she eventually does, essentially leaving Therese stranded somewhere in the Midwest. Abby doesn't show up at all in the novel. Therese is completely on her own. Carol flies back, leaves Therese with the car, and while Carol is back in New York, she keeps writing to Therese to tell her she'll be back to see her in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, Therese is now in a boarding house waiting for Carol, who eventually tells her she can't make it and essentially ends their relationship. Now Therese starts to kind of like lose her mind. She's hallucinating.
What?
She moves out of the boarding house and into a hotel. She's super depressed, obviously. And then I guess she starts a new life in this random town. She gets a job as a secretary at like a lumberyard or something.
Oh my
and then
God.
I'm not really sure how long she ends up staying there.
Wow.
She does eventually go back to New York. But that's why I think there's this two-year span of time in the
book.
Oh,
that makes more sense, yeah.
In the movie,
yeah,
it doesn't necessarily feel like that.
Huh. Neat.
Yeah. So I'm glad they didn't do that in the film because it's kind of fucked up. But as I keep talking about like how internal everything is for Therese, like we know what's going on in her mind and she's in her obsession with Carol. It's such a big part of the book. Like at one point she talks about the tunnel. I think actually the tunnel caving in and killing them both and
having their bodies
like get dragged out together.
Dragged out together.
So there's stuff like that, which is like way more intense and dramatic. I do think Rooney Mara does like a good job conveying the internal like sort of intensity, but I'm kind of glad we don't have access to that monologue that we do in the book.
Oh, that's true. That's one of the things I did hear some of what Phyllis Nagy said about that. Like it's just not as filmic, mm-hmm. right, to have voiceover for everything
all the time
all of her thoughts. So that's partially the reason behind her being a photographer versus like a set designer, was it allowed her to make visible some of the obsessiveness of that character.
Yeah, and as we were talking about earlier, like Carol's more of a maternal figure in this, the book, to Therese. Like I think at one point, this didn't happen in the movie, right? Where like Therese isn't feeling well, so Carol sends her upstairs to take a nap, and then I think she brings her a glass of milk. Something like that happens.
And it's, oh my God.
I can't remember the exact details, so I might be like misremembering, but there's definitely some like milk scene. It's like super creepy. So I think Phyllis Nagy and Todd Haynes did a good job kind of scrubbing a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I do get the sense that like Therese represents Highsmith like a little bit more closely in the novel form.
Would you recommend the book?
I would.
Okay.
I wonder if the other 40-something percent would as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think just to see the contrast, and Patricia Highsmith is an incredible writer. I don't want to speak to her as a person, but I think it's worth reading as sort of this historical piece of like art, you know. I've read other lesbian pulp novels from the same time, and they're like nothing in comparison.
Yeah, great.
Two quick things before we say goodbye. There have been two other adaptations, or unsuccessful, I guess, in one case, adaptations of this book. There was actually an attempt made in the early 50s to turn the novel into a movie. In the screen treatment, the title was changed to Winter Journey, and the character of Carol was changed to Carl.
Just doesn't have the same...
Carl.
Carl. It would always be Carl. 1,000 cities, 1,000 countries.
I'm going to get you that shirt.
Carl.
For Christmas. It'll always be Carl.
No. It's Carl season, everybody.
Oh,
doesn't
no.
even make sense.
It's
no.
so, it's like heterosexuals get everything. Everything. Every love story. You
God.
Need to change the price of salt to a straight love between, you know,
oh
like, like it makes zero sense. Oh, come on. Give me a fucking break.
It's like lesbians have this one thing, and then straights are like, no, that too. We're taking that as well. It's Carl now. It's like, oh, it's not
it's
even
Carl'd
a good...
It's Carl'd now. I think that's going to be the term for it. It's Carl. Yeah. You Carl'd that.
Yeah. Oh, gross. What would that even have been like? Ew. Man.
How does that work? Where's the conflict in that? Like,
so a man comes to the department store to buy his kid a present.
Yeah, I don't know.
And then he leaves
it's
his
totally
gloves.
Different film. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
Wait, the gloves weren't in the book, though, right?
I can't remember.
No, Phyllis, that's one of the things that Phyllis Nagy was saying is like, everyone remembers them being in the book, but they weren't there.
I know, no. Thanks,
like,
Phyllis. Like, I know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's been, I haven't read the book in years, so I can't remember, but yeah.
I think she sends her a Christmas card or something. But the gloves were a way to like kind of shortcut all that, because then you'd have to explain the thought behind like
right.
why a Christmas card. Anyway.
One other adaptation which actually happened was a radio adaptation, which was titled Carol and broadcast by BBC Radio in 2014 with Miranda Richardson as Carol. I don't know. Just a fun factory.
Have you?
I've not heard that. It's like just a few. It's like four episodes and they're like all 15 minutes each. So I'm like, how?
Yeah.
our show is longer than that. We just did a synopsis. What did they do?
I'm
kind of curious.
Yeah.
Yeah. dokie. Wow, thank you for... I mean, if you haven't seen the film in a long time and you just sat through our lengthy synopsis of it, you're welcome.
I wonder how well this would align with the actual film.
I mean, we're like 100. I mean, this is recording wise, not edited wise. Right, yeah, we're like an hour 20 minutes in, so, or almost hour 25 minutes in. So.
And we skipped like all of the straight parts, basically. The awkward Christmas dinners and like.
We scrubbed our episode of any triggering straight moments. Again, you're welcome.
That's the service that we provide.
This is our New Year's gift to you.
Unstraightening media.
Okay, and now it's time for this episode's Media Rex. Take it away, Laurel.
My Media Rec for this episode is a song. It is just a song.
And you're going to sing it for us right now.
I am not, because it's by Brandi Carlile and her voice is incredible. This is an interesting rec for me because Brandi Carlile, while incredibly talented and very good, primarily works in a genre that I don't frequent.
Is like your part way of my listening around this. Primarily works in a genre that I don't frequent. This is how Laurel talks all the time.
I don't really like country and folk music that much. Okay, like I feel.
It's okay. This is a safe space to say that.
Thank you. Yeah, and if you do, that's great. It's great. But Allie and I heard her perform Right on Time when she did her. She was on SNL recently, and it was amazing. It's such a great song, and. I listened to it again a couple days ago, and it's been stuck in my head since then. So I will link to that in the show notes. What's yours?
Mine is Cassandra Peterson's autobiography, Yours Cruelly. Cassandra Peterson is the person behind Elvira, as you may or may not know. I think probably may. Elvira is a gay icon.
Yay. And she was a gay icon just for being like generally queer and in horror.
Before coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she released this autobiography a few months ago, I think. And it's just so good. It's such a joy to read. I don't know if she wrote it or if she had a ghostwriter or like a mix of both. But like there's just this energy to her writing that's made it very fun and just like a nice distraction from everything else that's going on in 2021/2022 now. And her life is just a bonkers adventure, like starting from like day one. I don't know, it's like it sounds almost like fictional. I can't, but like every page I'm like, what, how, like you almost hooked up with Jimi Hendrix, just all the stuff keeps happening to her where I'm like,
yeah,
how is it possible? But I kind of believe it. I mean, I definitely believe it.
I feel like that feels about right. Like I'd be surprised if Elvira had a boring life.
It is the most exciting life you could imagine.
Great, love it. And now it's time for this episode's GaySMR, which is Walking on Snow. And Audrey has written here, Walking on Snow, Crunch Crunch. Would you like to explain where this is going to come from?
This is a Tahoe snow. Lake Tahoe has snow, and I walk on snow. That's my description.
It's been a long episode. It's hard to get the rest of this out.
Yeah. So, Iggy, you listen. 'Tis the season, right? Like, it's festive. This is the only time you're probably going to hear us walking on snow
for
at least a year. So, please enjoy it. In the meantime, do you have any sapphic questions for the next show? You can let us know by emailing us at sapphicultureclub@gmail.com. Also, you can find us on Instagram at Sapphic Culture Club and Twitter at Sapphic Podcast. And now, please enjoy this Snow SMR.
Snow SMR.